Good evening, everyone. Shalom Aleichem. Thank you very much. It's always a privilege to be here, and I mention this every year. This is Baruch Hashem, I think year number 9 or 10, I forget what a year, what it is. It's my favorite time of the year and favorite shiur of the year, because it really is, it's a shiur with a purpose in trying to inspire myself and maybe hopefully others to be able to give over meaningful ideas, thought-provoking questions, and divrei Torah at the Seder. It's also an opportunity, as you've noticed the last couple of years, to say thank you to my dear colleagues. There are Rabbanim in the front to my left. Here at Young Israel West Hemsa, we are very lucky, Baruch Hashem, blessed, actually, to have a fantastic group of Rabbanim who are great partners and friends, and who over the course of the year give amazing shiurim in divrei Torah. And it's an opportunity for me to be makar tov to them for all they do. So thank you for being here tonight, and thank you for the entire year as a whole. Really appreciate it so much. Of course, before we begin divrei Torah, to think about, as we go into this year's Pesach, to think about also that as we approach our Seder and sit down this year, and hopefully amongst family or friends, we have to realize that there are those this year who are either missing family members at their Seder, or have children, sons and daughters who are serving on the front lines in Israel, and therefore they are not able to have a full Seder. And so, of course, as we sit down with excitement and real jubilation and feeling of chayrus, on the other hand, it's important to balance that with a feeling of reality that we have to recognize the brachas that we have and hopefully think about those who are missing those at their table. And hopefully we should hear good news in Mirtzah Hashem soon, God willing, that safety, security in Eretz Yisrael, peace for everyone, for all of Klal Yisrael, of course, and safety for our soldiers. We should hear good news in Mirtzah Hashem soon. Okay. That being said, we're going to begin tonight a little bit before the Haggadah with something about Ma'os Chitin, because I think that's something I forget every year, is that leading up to Pesach, the night of the Seder, we forget about Ma'os Chitin. We give Ma'os Chitin, but thinking about the purpose and what the meaning behind it is. So I want to share with Elimelech Biderman's that's all. Shlita. Let's write that from the record. Chas v'shalom. I once in my previous shul, when I was speaking with Rav Wolfson, and Munas Itecha, I said that, and somebody corrected me. And so, God forbid, he's wonderful and well. He should be well for many years and teach Torah for many years. Whew, thank God. Okay, so says something so powerful. The Bnei Yisachar, he quotes, unbelievable in terms of Ma'os Chitin and Tzedakah. Here's what he writes. Ashrei maskil eldol b'yom ra'ah yimaltehu Hashem. Praiseworthy is the person who is maskil eldol, who thinks about, considers the poor person. B'yom ra'ah, on their day of difficulty, yimaltehu Hashem, Hashem will save them. Bnei Yisachar says, or Biderman echoes this idea, something so unusual. He said, when you hear the word maskil, what do you think of? Who are the maskilim? The intellectuals, those who were rejected Torah ideals and Torah ideas and all of halacha, they were the maskil, the intellectuals. Nothing to do with Yiddishkeit, they wanted only to be an academic world, that was it. The Bnei Yisachar said, or Biderman echoes this idea, he says that when it comes to a dal, when it comes to a poor person giving them tzedakah, giving them support, ashrei maskil el dal. You know, when somebody is a bal halacha, a talmid chacham, they think, are they really a poor person? They have the din of a poor person. Maybe they really have enough. Maybe they have to give someone else. There's all kinds of cheshbonos we make in terms of our calculations, in terms of the world of halacha. For Biderman quotes Bnei Yisachar, he says, ashrei maskil adol. When it comes to adol, you know what you should do? You should become a maskil. Don't believe in halacha. Abandon all the halacha. Forget your calculations. Are they really considered to be an ani, or do they deserve ma'os chitin? Be a maskil when it comes to giving tzedakah. Just forget about all of the diunim, all the cheshbonos. Just give. Just give. What a profound insight. And he quotes the pasuk in Perek Yudalev Tehillim, Atzas ani tavishu ki Hashem machzeyu. The Atzas ani tavishu. He says, You shouldn't say, Hashem machseyu. Hashem's going to provide for them. No, it's your job to provide for them. So as we prepare for the Seder to realize, there are those, unfortunately, we know, who have difficulty making a Seder and making a Yomtiv. Yomtiv is terribly expensive. To think about the idea that we should hopefully, with pride and great excitement, as we go into the Seder with excitement for all the Divrei Torah and all of the experience of the Seder, be just as excited for the opportunity to give tzedakah to those who are in need before Pesach. There's nothing more enjoyable than thinking about those who are able to help to make a Pesach. Ashrei maskil adol, that's the word of the B'nai Yisrael, Rabbi Biderman quotes, Shlita, Rabbi Biderman quotes in his Haggadah. In terms of the introduction of the Simanim and the Seder, the Novominsk Rebbe, that's all. Passed away a couple of years ago, just to be clear, when everybody's here, right? Says something unbelievable. In Parakuf Yotes of Tehillim, the Pasuk says, Ta'isi kiseh oved, bikesh avdecha ki mitzvasecha lo shachachti. Ta'isi kiseh, David HaMelech says, I am wandering like a sheep. I'm a lost person like a sheep. So how is somebody found if you're wandering like a sheep? So David HaMelech writes, Kiv mitzvosecha shachachti. Why am I wandering? Because I've forgotten my mitzvos. When somebody loses an object and they're trying to find it, so how are you machzir a lost object? The person has to provide simanim. So Rav Novominsk Rebbe says, at the beginning of the Seder, what do we declare? The whole year round, since the last Pesach, we became a nation. And over the course of the year, chip away, chip away, chip away, we slowly fade away from that national feeling and the same feeling towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're like a seh ove, we're like a lost sheep. Well, if a sheep wants to be returned, what do we need? We need simanim. What are our simanim? Kadesh, urchatz, karpas, yachatz. Those simanim are not just giving the Seder of the Seder. You know what they're doing? They're saying a message to Hashem. You may think, Hashem, over the course of the year we faded away. Look what I have. I have mitzvos. That's my simanim, those are my signs that I haven't forgotten about you over the course of the year. So we start with simanim with the idea, the notion that we're showing HaKadosh Baruch Hu we're not a lost sheep. We're giving the signs that in fact we belong to Him and He belongs to us. And that's why the Novominsk Rebbe writes, that's why we start the Seder with simanim to express that idea to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And last one for tonight before I give you over to my dear colleagues is Rabbi Biderman again in the Sefer on Purim. Not on Pesach, on Purim. So, in a footnote, he writes the following. One of the things on our plate, we've mentioned on Shabbos and the Shir, is the egg, the beitzah, the roasted egg. One of Shnei Tavshilim. Very good. Now, you could have any two Tavshilim on the plate. The minhag has become, Rama mentions to have the egg and the zeroah. Why an egg? Out of all things to roast, why the egg? Different reasons are given, the round nature of it, very good. Rabbi Biderman writes that the egg represents, you know, you have an egg, and inside is a yolk. That egg could have become a chicken. The egg is supposed to remind us of the potential that we have, each of us, to become something greater. So as we begin the Seder and we go through the Seder table and look at the Seder plate, the egg is supposed to be reminding us that what we could become as people. Furthermore, he writes that it also reminds us that when you see an egg hatched from a chicken, what do we know? Something else will come from the egg. Is the Seder, Rabbi Biderman writes, the end game, or just the beginning? The Seder, the Geula, was the beginning as the first step towards Matan Torah. Just like the egg is just the beginning of what will be eventually an actual life of the chicken, so too, the Seder is the beginning of what will be eventually a Mirtz Hashem, our Kabbalah Torah, which happens, of course, later on Shavuos. That's a symbol of the egg. Without further ado, I give you to my dear colleagues for the next Divrei Torah.
Parshas Rabbi Galler and our wonderful rabbinic team over here, it's such a real honor to be part of this beautiful night. We're going to assume that everyone is already experts in Kadesh, Orchatz, and Karpas. We're up to Yachat. See? Seder's moving along very, very nicely. We break the matzah to have this lechem oni, this poor man's bread in pieces, put the bigger half away for the afikomen, we recite Halach Ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction. The Gemara Maseches Pesachim says, Mat Darko Shel Ani Beprusa. A poor person isn't able to eat all that's in front of them. They don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. So they have to store even the majority of what they have left for later, just in case they don't get anything else later. They only could eat bits at a time, putting the bigger half away. I once heard Moshe Weinberger give a beautiful drasha on this idea of starting the Seder as aniyim. We are not just aniyim in an impoverished, indigent, monetary sense, but in terms of faith, in terms of amuna, we are poor. When people are enslaved, when they're not able to make autonomous decisions, they are poor, and they are not able to be trusting. To be trusting of someone else, to be vulnerable, to open yourself up, to trust in someone else to take care of you, requires a great rich sense of emuna. As recent slaves in this process, halach ma'anya, we are very poor. We can't trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu to take care of us yet. And therefore, we're going to put the bigger amount away for later. We eat just the minimum we have to eat now, not fully believing, not fully having that emuna, just lach ma'anya at this point. Pour in our emuna that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can take care of us. And then, over the course of the Seder, we're trying to leave that mindset, to actually go to Cheres, to stop being poor in our emuna, to build up a sense of trust, to build up a sense of faith, where we're no longer going to need to have food away in the closet, to have pas pesala. Just as HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when taking us out of Mitzrayim, we were very little fledglings in terms of our emuna in Hashem, mem tashari tuma, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the man, a different kind of a bread, alechem min Hashemayim, to build faith, to build trust in Hashem, not to have something in the cupboard for later. That was the inui of the man. Pasuk in Parshas Ekev, machilcha, man b'midbar, leman anosecha, to cause inui by eating man. Kids are always so excited. I want the man to taste like a hot dog covered in raspberry jelly and gummy bears. Man sounds exciting, but the pasuk sounds like the man is an inui. It's a torture, it's a painful process. The Gemara Maseches Yudmandaf Ayin Dalet says, it's an inui to have only enough for today with nothing left in the closet. Not to have pas pesala, not to have any bread stored away for the end. You have to trust that the man's going to fall again tomorrow. And that was the faith building of leaving Mitzrayim. We have to learn to trust in Hashem, not to have bread stored away for later. And this is the process we're going through on Seder night. We start off very, very poor. And we're working toward, through the Makos, the Osos, the Mofsim, the tradition we're going to hear, Divrei Torah tonight, the purpose is to build that faith. So by the end of the night, we take that stuff and we take that which was hidden away, and we could take it out, and we could eat it, and leave nothing behind. Weinberger said, we no longer call it at that point, Lach Ma'anya. You know what we call it? Afiku Man. Take out the Man. Afiku is Aramaic for take out. At this point, we can take out the Man, and we could eat the Man, and we can leave nothing else behind. Because now we're fully of faith. Now we're rich. We're rich in our emuna. We're rich in our belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who provided for us, who continues to provide for us, who will continue to provide for us. This is the transformative process of Maggid, of the Seder, to start off with Lach Ma'anya, with the end game in mind, to be able to think about, by the end of this process, can we believe in Hashem to provide for all of our needs, where we're not going to have pas pesala, we're not going to have anything in storage. It ends off with the afiku man, with the taking out of that man. But at the beginning of this process, we're still expecting a wonderful night of the Divrei Torah, of the Chorus in Amuna, that allows us to build that faith, to go from Lechem Oni to Afikomen.
Perhaps one of the most famous questions in all of the Haggadah, literally all of the Haggadah, probably every year somebody asks this question, whether young, old, seen the Haggadah 5 times or 45 times. Famous question. Avadim Hayinu. So we recite in the middle of that paragraph something which is so startling. V'ilu atzei HaKadosh Baruch Hu es avosinu Mitzrayim. If Hashem hadn't taken us out of Mitzrayim, hari anu uvanenu uvnevanenu mishibadim hayinu lefar b'Mitzrayim. We and our children and our grandchildren would be mishubad, would be enslaved or indebted to Paro in Mitzrayim. Are we really to believe that? Are we supposed to believe the Bahagadah is telling us that really if Hashem had taken us out on that fateful night so many thousands of years ago, we'd still be there today? And our children, our grandchildren, Meshubad in Egypt? I mean, you see how the world works? empires have risen, empires have fallen. We've still been under Greece, under Rome, like they're all gone. So really to believe that the Baal Gada wants us to understand that if Hashem hadn't performed a miracle on that night, we'd still be there right now in Egypt. Unbelievable. So of the many answers that I saw a new one this year that really struck me, really unbelievable. In the drashos of the Chasam Sofer, he says something unbelievable. One of the most important midos that we speak about so often, anybody who's a Talmud of Hank, Raganisman Zatzal, what was his favorite mida? Hakarat Hatov, being makir tov, showing gratitude and thanks. The Chasam Sofer says, we wouldn't be in Mitzrayim today if Hashem hadn't taken us out. That's just not the case. It's not reality. We know it's not reality. What the Baal Gada is telling us is that, let's say Hashem had decided, I'm going to wait a little longer. And all of a sudden, Paro woke up and said, you know what? I've just had enough. My people are suffering. I'm suffering. I'm going to let them go. So ironically, what would happen? Yes, for 210 years plus, we were enslaved and beaten and mistreated and starved. All that's true. But now Paro let us go. So we're conflicted. On one hand, we have all the torture and the beating and the starvation and the terrible years in Mitzrayim. On the other hand, Yah just tells us, be makir tuah, Paro let us go. So writes the Chasam Sofer, Hashem did a chesed shebe chesed. He took us out, plus he didn't give Paro the opportunity to let us go, because then we'd be indebted to him for that forever. So writes the Chasam Sofer, what does it mean? Haryanu uvanenu uvnevanenu mishubadim hayinu lefar mitzrayim. We'd be mishubad. It doesn't mean enslaved, like the word eved. When I'm mishubad to somebody else, what does that mean? I owe them something. I owe them something. Hashem said, I don't want you ever to feel like you owe Paro anything. And so Hashem said, I'm not going to wait one more second. This way, you won't have that internal conflict, because Hashem understands that for a Jew not to be makir tov is impossible. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in his great wisdom, decided, I'm taking them out. This way, they shouldn't have any shemetz, any small amount of hakaras hatov to Paro at all, only towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chvodo uv'atmo. Seder night recognizes the idea that, of course, the entire Seder is about this, but we forget sometimes. It's hakaras hatov only in one direction. Only Kape Shmaya. And that's the idea of the Chasam Sofer in terms of what this verse means in the Avad Mahayiru.
Just like with America right now, not supporting Israel.
Yeah, on the same note. Okay,
very good.
Rosh Hashanah Rabbonim, Rosh everyone who came out tonight. So continuing in the very next line in the Haggadah, in Avad Mahayinu, we say, Afilu kulanu chachamim, even if we were all chachamim, even if we were all wise, kulanu nivonim, kulanu yodim asa Torah, even if we were very knowledgeable in Torah, mitzvah leinu l'saper b'tzias Mitzrayim. It would be a mitzvah for us to fulfill this obligation of si b'tzias Mitzrayim. And last year, my Rebbe Rav Twersky asked, of course, when else do we ever have a thought that a big tamach chacham, that someone who's very smart, very knowledgeable in Torah, doesn't have to fulfill a commandment midoraisa? There's a mitzvah in the Torah of mitzvah l'saper b'tzias Mitzrayim. So why is the Haggadah even entertaining the possibility that a chacham maybe shouldn't have to do it, a navon? Maybe if we've heard this many times, we don't have to fulfill the mitzvah of saper b'tzias Mitzrayim. And if Twersky explained, you have to understand a little bit about the way we go about saper b'tzias Mitzrayim, which we know, which is through an obsession of questions. Everything on the Seder night is about questions. Why? And especially, there are certain things that are just seem odd. Why do we have these, make so many shinuyim, so many changes, that have children ask questions just for us to tell us, oh, we did that so you would ask? Such a bizarre thing. Furthermore, as Twersky pointed out, the Gemara says that if a person is unfortunately alone for Seder night, certain people had this during COVID, and they don't have a child or anyone else to ask the manashtana, they ask themselves. They ask themselves the manashtana. What does that mean? How can you ask yourself a question? There seems to be a certain obsession with making sure we're asking questions on the Seder night. And so this part, I'll add a little bit of color to what Twersky said with a linguistic point. What is a she'ela? What is a question? What does that really mean when we ask a question? Sheila, the word in Hebrew, actually has three meanings that I'm familiar with in Hebrew. One is to ask a question. Sheila is a question. Another is Sheila means borrowing. When I ask you, can I please borrow your shovel? That's called Sheila. And the third is an interesting halacha regarding vows. If I take a vow and then I kind of regret it, I can go to a chacham and I do she'elas chacham. I have him retroactively undo the vow. I didn't realize a certain thing, it would be too hard for me. I do she'elah. Why are those three things connected? And so I was thinking that probably, and this is really what Rav Tversky was getting at, but I'm just adding a little bit, she'elah means exposing a lacking. Exposing a lacking could be exposing a lacking in the vow, that the vow really wasn't a valid vow and therefore I can retroactively undo it. It could be exposing the fact that I don't have a shovel, so can I please borrow your shovel? Or it can be in my knowledge. I don't have all the knowledge, therefore I ask you a question. So the idea of Seder night, why we're so obsessed with asking questions and creating a culture of inquisitiveness amongst the children, even if a person is on their own, they ask themselves, the idea is that we're supposed to realize we don't actually know everything about this story. There's more depth here. Maybe there are holes in the story that I never realized before. Maybe there are aspects of the suffering or of the geula that I never realized in previous years, even though we've gone through this so many times. Explains Rav Tversky, that's why there was a thought that maybe a chacham wouldn't have to do Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. He's actually seen everything. If it's a sliding scale that you just have to ask a she'ela, realize you don't know something, well, someone who actually knows everything shouldn't have the chiyuv of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. But we say you do. What's the kamash malan? Why does a chacham need to fulfill the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim? Because it's a fallacy. You never really know everything. There's always more depth. There's always more to discover. There's always more to appreciate about the story, about the details, about the broader picture. And that's why everything is al derech sheila, asking questions, realizing that I don't know everything, and therefore there's more to discover.
The real mitzvah is for children to ask their parents questions, but my father likes to ask the question at the Seder every year. And part of tradition is I have to say over this question. My father always wants to know, how do we know the Baal Haggadah was a dentist? Because he encourages Haki Yashinav, more business for the dentist. That's what my father likes to say every single year. Such an unusual language when the Russia, one of the four sons, asked the question, Ma Havodah Zos Lachem. Okay, we can analyze the fact that he has certain language that seems to be kofer be'ikr. Lachem below lo, lefisha hotzi, es atzvam and aklal. I get that part. Haki yashinov, knock out his teeth. What does that mean? The Torah Tumima, in his Haggadah Baruch She'amar, has a very clever understanding of what we're trying to tell the Rasha with that response. Haki yashinov. He says that the Rasha's real question is, Maha avodah hazos lachem. What are you doing? Look, you want to sit around and tell the story? Fine. Just sit there and think about what happened. You want to remember what God once did for us many, 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 many years ago? So you sit here and think about it. And for that matter, why are we doing any of these mitzvot tonight or any time of the year? There's an idea of connecting to God. So let's philosophize. Let's sit around and let's think about God. Does God really care about what kind of boxes I put on my arm or whether I ingest this flatbread tonight? Who cares? What are you doing? Does God really care about the things that you do? Shouldn't it be enough just to intellectualize and think about these ideas without having any avoda, having any meisim to do? And our response, says the Torah Tumima, is Haki Yashinav. We say to him, good question. You're probably looking forward to eating something tonight. That's probably why you're here. You don't want anything else we're doing tonight. You can't wait. You keep looking at the pages. Half are in English. Okay, so we're almost there. But when are we going to get to eat? When do we get to Shulchan Aruch? Why do you need to eat? Knock out your teeth. Let's say you don't have any teeth. Just sit there and let's philosophize about the meal. Isn't that enough for you to intellectually imagine food on a menu? Take a cookbook and have a good time. You don't like this book? Take that book. Isn't that enough for you? Haki Yashinov, why do you need teeth? You understand that to read a cookbook, to intellectualize everything, doesn't leave you feeling satisfied. And that's our response to you as well. Mahavodah zos lachem. Why are we doing all these things tonight and year round? Same reason we have to have teeth. It's not enough just to intellectually see ourselves as a distant reader of a story. We are living actually through this. We are actualizing it. We are manifesting something in poel, in action, that leaves us feeling satisfied. We need to internalize what's going on tonight. He is hotzi himself, lachem v'lo. He doesn't feel part of it. He feels removed. He feels you can just see it as an outsider. And we say, we're in it. That's kofar be'ikr. You wouldn't have been redeemed. You weren't part of that story. To be part of the story means to experientially live the story. And for that, you got to have teeth. For that, you got to ingest something. You got to infuse something tonight. And that's our goal for tonight. Not to make the mistake of the Rasha. We're going to tell the story and turn some pages and get to the meal. To realize what we're doing before the meal is we are ingesting. We are infusing ourselves in an experiential way with the lessons of Amuna, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Nisim and the flows for us. Master Begnos, Umesai B'Shelach, we are going through all of it. We are letting all of it go through us. And in that way, we truly eat and enjoy and digest all the lessons of tonight.
We'll move to the next section of the Haggadah, which begins with the words, Baruch Shomer Havtachas Li Yisrael. And in that paragraph, we say, blessed is Hashem who keeps his promise to the Jewish people. We read about the Bris Bein HaBesarim. The Bris Bein HaBesarim, the treaty, the Nevuah that was given to Avraham Avinu about the many generations of evil that the Jewish people would experience over the course of their national development. Hashem charters the blueprint of Jewish history in the Bris Bein HaBesarim when he appears to Avraham in Parshas Lech Lecha. And he tells him, Yadoa teida ki ger yezar acha be'eres lolohem. You should know that your children will be amongst a foreign nation, and they'll be slaves, and they'll be persecuted. And Chazal explained how in that Nevuah we learn about all the exiles, all the galios, and all the persecutions that have befallen the Jewish people throughout our history. That's the blueprint. And with this, we begin our story of the Haggadah that Hashem decreed from the beginning, that there would be exile and there would be slavery. In 1956, Rav Soloveitchik delivered a monumental drasha, which we know of as the drasha called Kol Dodi Dofek. In that drasha, it was given on Yom Ha'atzma'ut, 1956, the eighth Yom Ha'atzma'ut in Israel's national history. And Rav Soloveitchik, in that drasha, he spoke about the State of Israel and the Zionist movement. But in the beginning of the drasha, he addressed one of the most sensitive questions in Jewish literature, namely the question of evil. Question of why it is that Hashem makes Jewish people go through bad things. Why it is, so to speak, that we had a Bris Bein HaBesarim with a blueprint charters that the Jewish people will have in exile and will experience tzaros. And the Rav there offers an approach which is instructive, and he says that when we ask a question like why, the Rav says there are two words in the Hebrew language which mean why. One word is madua, and the other word is lama. Why do we have two different words for why? The Rav said because they mean different things. Madua means what's the reason that this happened? Why did this need to happen? What's the reason for it? And the Rav said madua we could never know the answer to. Why Hashem decided something should happen? What's the reason that Hashem decided we should be slaves in Mitzrayim? What's the reason for something to happen? The Rav said we can't necessarily know the answer to that question. But there's another question, lama. Lama comes from the word lima, towards what? Which is a different type of why. Not why in the sense of what's the reason that this needed to happen, but towards what purpose is this going? Where is this leading? Where is this taking us to a better place because of this? So what was the lima of Sheba Mitzrayim? What was the lima, the lama question of the slavery in Egypt, the persecution in Egypt? Where was the better place that the Jewish people came to because of Sheba Mitzrayim? There are many, many answers to the question, many approaches one could take, but I want to share with you a particularly powerful quote from one of the Sfarim that compiles the drushos of Rav Soloveitchik. This is from a different drush. I'll share with you a quote of Rav Soloveitchik, which in his formulation was the lima, or one of the limas of Shibud Mitzrayim. And he writes as follows: the experience of Egyptian servitude underlies the very morality of the Jew. If asked, what characterizes Jewish morality? I would answer with a single Yiddish word, Rachmanus. The English translations of mercy, compassion, sympathy, or empathy do not capture its full meaning. Rachmanus refers to the exceptionally tender and warm approach of one individual to another. The word rachamim in Hebrew is derived from rechem, the womb. It means the love of a mother for her child. And here comes the connection to Mitzrayim. The fact that in Egypt, the Jews were exposed to all kinds of chicanery and humiliation. The fact that they were treated there like objects, not people, engendered in the Jewish people sensitivity and tenderness toward their fellow man. Our extraordinary sensitivity to the widow and orphan bears witness to our sympathetic understanding of and involvement in the travail of others. This would never have happened if not for our sojourn in Egypt. Without the experience of slavery, we would have remained unexposed to suffering, emotionally vulgar, and insensitive. And the Rav goes on to explain that it's for this reason that we find throughout the Torah in many places where it gives us mitzvos of chesed, mitzvos of taking care of those who are in need, the Torah always tells us to do so because you were slaves in Egypt. Because remember, you were avadim in Mitzrayim, because that sensitivity, that deep sense of empathy, which, as the Rav said, does not fully capture the word rachmanus, that deep sense of rachmanus, was something we learned in Mitzrayim and is part of the lema of Mitzrayim. And it's worth thinking about the Baruch Shomer Avtachasu of our Seder, when we think about Jewish history and Jewish destiny, and what Klal Yisrael have experienced, when we think about what it means to develop that deep sense of rachamim for another Jew, whether through the communal tzaros Klal Yisrael have experienced, whether on a personal difficulty, builds within a person that degree of rachmanus. Worth thinking about how that's a lema that can come out and be channeled towards our rachmanus that we have towards our fellow Jews.
Who wrote the music to Vihisha Amda? Was Yaakov Shweki?
No.
Oh, thank God, Meir's here.
Yonatan Reizel and Yaakov Shweki.
Okay, so joint credit. So I want to share with you a quick story before we go into the Haggadah. Several months ago, I had the privilege of chaperoning a trip of my students from DRS to Israel. Anybody who's been to Israel recently knows that life in Israel, although Baruch Hashem, there's a lot of light, there's a lot of radiance, there's a lot of amazing, amazing things happening. And if you know me, I don't use the word amazing very often. There's also some staggering things to see as well. I don't want to go too deeply into it, but we, as Rabbi Twersky pointed out two Sundays ago, we've basically lived a world of beautiful, beautiful shalom, comfort, casualness. I'm not calculating what I'm going to wear when I go into the city because I feel very, very safe and very, very at home. Now we're approaching the six-month anniversary where the reality for Israel is fundamentally changed, as well as our reality living in the Golos. And so last year, when we sang Vihisha Amda, Lavoseinu Velanu, felt like there was a nostalgia to it, like, yeah, you know, the Nazis, the Holocaust, Khamnitsky massacres, Tach V'Tat. But in our lifetimes, it felt like more of a historical artifact than something that was Nogea Lamaisa. But it was something practically meaningful for our daily experience. But if we think back at Jewish history, the Vihisha Amda, I think for most generations of Jews, was something which was at the forefront of their mindset. The Vihisha Amda is when he talked about that people remember this happened to my aunt, this happened to my uncle, and we think about all of the various permutations of anti-Semitism that have existed throughout history. Anti-Semitism, as Rabbi Sachs powerfully points out, also quoted recently, Rabbi Sachs says anti-Semitism is a virus. And what are the two midos that viruses have? Viruses are able to mutate, and viruses are able to move quickly from place to place. So anti-Semitism has had many, many guises, personalities, and permutations over the generations. And for us, when we sit down at the Seder this year, when we see V'hisha Amdalav Hussein Uvilanu, there's going to be a lot more resonance for the word Lanu. It wasn't just for them, but it's something that's happening today. The scariness about anti-Semitism today is not just that it's there, but it's become so prolific and so virulent throughout the world. And of course, the focal point of today's anti-Semitism is, of course, Eretz Yisrael, Medinas Yisrael, and the Jews who live there. So when we read V'hisha Amda, it's important to remind ourselves that this is not the first time that we've been through this. In fact, the Aruch HaShulchan in his commentary on their Seder says it specifically comes after the story of the Bris Bein HaBesarim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us that there are going to be people who are going to find ways to try to destroy us. Why do they try to destroy us? Well, Rabbi Sachs and Eli Wiesel all say, we don't know. We don't know because hate is something which is fundamentally irrational. Maybe it's because we're different. Maybe it's because we're successful. Maybe it's because we're not successful enough. When somebody doesn't like something, they don't have to find too many excuses not to like it. Shelo echad bilvad amar aleinu l'chal oseinu. And it's not just one moment in history, but it's continuous moments in history. It's a cycle. It's a tragic, frustrating, seemingly endless cycle. Ele b'chol dor v'dor, omdim aleinu l'chal oseinu. And in every generation, somebody is going to come up. It's going to be a Haman. It's going to be an Ahmadinejad. It's going to be a Yahya Sinwar. But a Kaddish Baruch Hu matzi leinu miyadam. So I started with a story. I'd like to end with a story. When I was studying in the Gros Kollel many years ago, even though it seems like yesterday, we asked our Rebbe, Rabbi David Miller, could we come to you for the Seder? He says, you don't want to come to my Seder. It's good. You want to get somebody not to come to your Seder? What's a good thing to say? You don't want to come to my Seder. Because Rebbe, why wouldn't we want to come to Rebbe's Seder? Because our Seder is all about the children. You're going to be expecting some beautiful Reb Chaims and some Chazar Nishes and some deep, deep Vertlach. I'm only interested in engaging the kids. So what do we do at the Seder when there are children at the table and we get to this passage? So it's a beautiful opportunity to get the children to realize that we're going through a difficult time right now. It's extremely challenging. Where are we going to get the omets? Where are we going to get the strength to get through it? HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzileinu Miyadam. We're not dealing with this as an historical footnote, but we're dealing it halacha lemaisa hayom, practical, applicational halacha hayom. And we should promise the kids, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Matzileinu Miyadam.
Every year when we read about the Makos and Sefer Shmos, I can't help but have a very cartoonish lens through how I see the story. That's my own fault. But it seems so cartoonish. Kadosh Baruch Hu has, this is going to be the plan that finally gets Pyro to give in. And for a while, it looks like something supernatural is happening, and for some of them more than others, Pyro seems to be moved and inspired and perhaps even willing to offer up some degree of freedom before, oh, I had my fingers crossed. And then the next plague comes and hits him again. It's like a Tom and Jerry kind of situation. You know, they get more elaborate and more cartoonish and more disastrous, and each time, he doesn't seem to learn. The Sforno points out in Chumash that the Torah doesn't necessarily use the word makkah, except for v'hikesi, by makkas v'choros. The Torah's main term is osos umofsim. These miracles are signs, they're wonders, they're miracles to make a point. They're etzba elokim hi. Hashem is pointing at something. These miracles are pointing at Hashem. Some kind of demonstration, some kind of sign to get Paro's attention. But Paro seems so obtuse. Because regardless of what miracles are happening, he doesn't just ignore them. He looks for the smallest, most trivial, minute details to poke a hole and say, nope, not convinced. There are many examples, but I'll give you a few. At the end of Makas Tzvardeya, Paro's had enough of the loud noise. And Moshe comes to take him away. And Moshe says, Hispar Eli, challenge me. L'masai atir l'chad. When should I daven to take the frogs away? And Paro says, you think he'd say, right now they're jumping all over me, my nose, my toes, my bed, my head, to get them out of here right now. And Paro says, L'machar, I can take one more day of this. Why? The Ramban says, Paro had a suspicion that Moshe really wasn't speaking from Hashem. Moshe may have already known the frogs were going to leave anyway today. And Moshe was hoping Paro would say, I want them gone right now. So Paro said, I'm not going to fall for your trick. Like the person who called up for a magic trick? I'll take the bottom card. No, tomorrow. They can go away tomorrow. Moshe says, fine, as you wish. In Makas Dever, the Pasuk says, after the animals in Mitzrayim died, Yishlach Paro, Paro sent around word to see what had happened. V'hinei lo meis mi mikne Yisrael ad achad. Which the Malbim says means he found that there may have been one Jewish person, up to one, maybe one Jewish animal had died. And Paro said, I'm out. Forget it, the miracle is over. One Jewish animal died too. Throws away the whole miracle. Torah Tamimah points out, after Makas Barad, Paro seems to be shaken. I have sinned, my people have sinned. You can go. And at the end, Bayar Paro, ki chadal hamatar v'habarad v'akolos, Paro sees that the hail and the rain and the thunder and lightning have stopped, and he hardens his heart. Says the Torah Tamimah, Moshe didn't say anything about the rain stopping. Paro says, aha, you didn't say the rain was going to stop. Must be you're a liar. I changed my mind. What is he picking up on? The Vilna Gaon says, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises there won't be any mashkes, no plague in the Jewish homes for Makas Bechoros, says the Vilna Gaon, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was promising no Jew would die tonight, even of natural causes. You would expect a population of several million people. Odds are someone should, of old age, pass away tonight. Not on this night. So Paro shouldn't say, one of yours died too tonight. Aha! He sees millions of people on his side dying, all the firstborns, exactly as foretold, but one Jewish animal died, one Jewish person died. And perhaps most famously and most troublesome, Moshe has to warn Paro, Kachatzos HaLeila, at around midnight, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will send this plague. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had said, at exactly midnight. Moshe couldn't say, Rashi quotes, exactly at midnight, because Paro would say, haha, he's off by a minute. Could you imagine? The Egyptian Paul Revere is running through, death is coming, death is coming. And some smug Paro is like, he's late. What are they using? A sundial? It's nighttime. How could they even know he's late? What are you talking about? Kachatzos? Exactly at midnight would confuse him? How obtuse is this guy? What's he hanging his hat on? Each miracle to say, nope, not convinced. What were these osos and mofsim, and why wasn't Paro convinced? Rabbi David Foreman from Aleph Beta has a beautiful mahalach to understand the real emunah, the real yisod trying to be conveyed throughout the entire story. Nowadays, our challenge when it comes to faith is it's hard for us to believe in the supernatural. It's hard for us to believe in the divine, of a power outside the forces of nature, beyond that which we can see and rationally explain. For us, seeing any one of these signs, or anything close to anything like it, would have us convinced. Back then, that wasn't the challenge. People weren't struggling with the idea of believing in the supernatural. They had too many supernaturals. They had lots of gods, and they had lots of powers. All kinds of powers stepping on each other's toes and infringing on each other's rights. And everything was chaotic because you have to serve this god and this god, and they all have different jurisdictions and different times. One's in charge of time, one's in charge of the weather, and one's in charge of this and that, and they just don't work together. And Moshe has this novel idea. There is one Hashem, there is one power above all these powers that coordinates everything. And Paro said, I've never heard of that. I believe in power. I believe in supernatural. I don't believe in that. The precision to coordinate everything? I don't believe in that. And so, Moshe makes it very clear throughout their dialogue, this is going to be a lesson in precision. This is going to be a lesson not just in power, but in ultimate power. The power above all other powers. And therefore, if you look at the dialogue, Moshe's response is not about there is a God. It's that ki ein kashem elokeinu. You should know, and everyone should know, that this power is the power above everything else, and you're going to see a precision like you've never seen before. And Paro says, when exactly this? Tomorrow, today, I want to know exactly when. I know things can happen, but I want to know when they're going to happen. And I want to know that this God can tell me exactly, with no holdups, because he has full carte blanche over everything, show me this is going to happen. So Amparo has the impression that, oh, it's not so precise. It wasn't just us. It was some of your animals, some of your people. God couldn't take away the lightning and the hail without taking away the rain. Maybe he's not as precise as you say he is. If one Jew dies too, maybe this power of yours is a power, but not as precise as you say. You can't be exactly on time. You can't exactly discriminate who is Jewish, who is not. And that's the dialogue back and forth. Those are the osos and mosim, not to prove that there are powers, but to prove in this supreme power. And Paro didn't get it. He made up his own loopholes. He made up his own excuses. He made up things that weren't true because he wasn't looking to be convinced. So are we to declare the entire mission a failure? Of course not. Torah describes in Erev Rav many people who were convinced. A Yisrael who hears about it and he wants to come. Also for the Jewish people. The Makos weren't just ways of punishing Mitzrayim or applying pressure to get us out. They were also samofsim to teach us something too. And as you read about the Makos on Seder nights, Paro may have been obtuse, too obtuse to get it, too cartoonish to understand pain and understand precision. But it's not lost on us. We have the opportunity to recognize this is how HaKadosh Baruch Hu identifies himself by Matan Torah, not the God who created the world, but the God who proved his precision and his ultimate supreme power over all other powers. That's the one who gave us the Torah. That's the one who we're fortunate to have a relationship with. As you read about these makos and take out some wine, it's an opportunity to think about a Kadosh Baruch Hu not just as a power, but the supernatural power, collaborating with all the powers under one source, having the ultimate power, and we're so lucky to have a relationship with him.
We move towards the end of Maggid. We encounter what is probably the hardest mitzvah of the Seder night. The Haggadah tells us, based on the Mishnah in the last parak of Maseches Pesachim, "Bechol dor vador chayav adam liros es atzmo ki ilu hu yatzam mimitrayim." In every generation, a person is obligated to see himself as if he or she left Mitzrayim. As the Rambam paraphrases from the Mishnah, "Ki iluhu yotza ata mishibud Mitzrayim," as if we left now, today, as if we are part of the redemption from Mitzrayim. Probably the hardest mitzvah to fulfill at the Seder night. How do we get into a frame of mind like that? To really to see ourselves, to relate to what it means to be a slave, to be in the shoes of a person who was persecuted and enslaved, and to see ourselves as if we are leaving Mitzrayim. It's a very difficult mitzvah to fulfill. But I want to share with you a conversation that I had earlier this week with my uncle, which may put some perspective on this mitzvah this year. My uncle lives in Eretz Yisrael. And Sunday morning I reached out to him, asked him how he was doing, how his family was doing, after the events of Motzei Shabbos. And he sent me this response. I'll read to you his text that he sent back to me. "Last night, the Iranian regime attacked the state of Israel with over 300 cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and drones. Thank God Israeli, American, British, and other allied forces shot down 99% of the missiles and drones. The video below," and he sent us a pretty remarkable video, "the video below was taken live from our porch at 2 a.m. as we witnessed this event. We are 1 week away from the Passover holiday, Pesach, in which we mark and celebrate the Jewish people's miraculous exodus from Egypt over 3,100 years ago. At that time, God promised, 'Ufasachti aleichem velo yiyevochem negef lemashchis,' I will pass over you, and there shall be no plague upon you. Last night, we witnessed the drones and missiles which were aimed at our homes being downed as they passed over and did not cause damage or harm. The prophet Micha said, 'Ki meitzeischa me'eretz Mitzrayim arenu nifla'os,' 'As in the days of the Exodus from Egypt shall I show marvelous and miraculous things.' V'sechazeno einenu, kayomim ha'heim, bazman hazeh."
Very powerful. Wow. Wow. If you ask somebody what is the most forgotten line of all of Haggadah, my guess is this would make the top three. And it might not even sound familiar to anybody here in the room because, and I'll tell you why in a minute, it's the introduction to Dayenu. And that's because when you see the Dayenu in front of you, turn the page of the Haggadah, and you see all the list of 15 different sections of Dayenu, the song starts right away. As an aside, those who recall my favorite songs, top 10 songs of my life, is the Maccabees Dayenu, where they take all these secular songs and make... Have you ever seen that one? It's the word is marvelous. It's absolutely marvelous. I know we're on tape, but Whitney Houston, the end of it, really the highlight of the... unbelievable. But I digress for a moment. Kama malos tovos lamakom aleinu. How many know that phrase? Almost nobody. One. Okay. Because when you turn the page, you start... Oh, Dayenu. You start the song right away. That one line is so powerful. But what's interesting is that, and this is not my ha'ara, the great Kedushas Levi, the Berditchever, the great Hasidish Rebbe pointed out that as many times we say that line, it's actually incorrect. I'm going to read it, anything in life, I was told this many years ago, I had a prabha in a certain shul many years ago, and they asked all of the candidates about what they think about the Kiddush Club. And so apparently I didn't get it right, I didn't get the job. But and by the way, I don't like Kiddush Clubs. But the guy who got the job, ironically, who was actually let go only 2 years later, he got the job on this one question. What was his answer? He said, I was taught many years ago by a professor that anything that's unusual, that's strange in life, say it slowly and see how it sounds. So the fellow said, grown men leave in the middle of shul to have alcohol and cake in front of children. Yeah, it doesn't sound so good. Yeah. So he got the job on that, yeah. I didn't say that, apparently. So, but writes the Berditchever, Kama malos tovos lamakom aleinu? No. Meha makom aleinu. From Hashem upon us. What do the words lamakom aleinu mean? To him on us. To him, with a capital H. How many milos, how many great elevations have we experienced? To him on us. Who's doing the giving? Who's doing the receiving here? We are the recipients of God's great chesed. All these 15 steps that we're going to about to recite, about to sing. Lamakom aleinu? What's going that way? Writes the Berditchever something unbelievable and actually reframed this entire song at the Seder. He says, we think sometimes that we are, of course, the Seder is about recounting all the great chasadim Hashem did for us in those days. Every step it unfolds point by point. All the details that Hashem put into making the geula an unbelievable, unforgettable experience. That's all the Seder night. But what about the Nachas Ruach that we gave him when he got to see us leave? Shouldn't that be counted somewhere in the Seder? Somewhere over the course of a 3, 4, 5, 6 hour night, we speak about all that he did for us. Hashem wants to kind of slip in and say, you know what? I enjoyed it also, by the way. It wasn't just you. So writes Kedushas Levi, nowhere he slipped it in the Bahagara, he slipped it in right over here. Kama ma'alos tavos. Yeah, aleinu, true, but lamakom. He, with a capital H, also got a credible nachas ruach from watching his people that he chose leave the koma zakufa with broad shoulders and confidence out of Mitzrayim. So yes, indeed, circling back, the night is about recognizing and celebrating our geula, but our geula also is his geula as well.
Skipping ahead a little bit, past the end of Magid, Rachta, Motzi, Matzah, going to Maror. So well before these viral internet challenges like the Ice Bucket Challenge and the Cinnamon Challenge, Klal Yisrael for years, and I think this is a minhag nafutz in all of Klal Yisrael, has had something called the Horseradish Challenge. At almost every Seder, just from speaking to people, speaking to friends, The minhag usually goes as follows. Usually some of the males, sometimes the older males at the table, will try to prove how much horseradish they can swallow at once during Maror, and then double down during Korech to show that it wasn't just one-off luck. They really... Sometimes it's better if your face gets red and you start crying. Sometimes it's better if you dafka. Your face doesn't get red. You don't start crying because you're that tough. And then there's the few of us, like myself, who are weak, and we have our romaine lettuce on the side, watching this all happen. And the question is, who did it better? Who's doing maror better? Do we assume the bitter, the better? Right. So it actually seems to be a discussion in the Gemara. One of the Amoraim may be an early echo of this minhag yisrael of the horseradish challenge. The Gemara says, Ravina ashchil arvacha brei derava, dehava mehader amarirta. One of the Amoraim, Rav Acha brei derava, he was seeking after a very bitter type of vegetable. Amar lei, so Ravina said to this particular Amora, my daitich, well, what is your thought process here that you're seeking after this very bitter herb? Dimiririn tfei, because it's so bitter. V'ha chazeres tanan. But the Mishnah teaches us that the first one on the list of the things that are kosher to use for maror is chazeres, which Rashi translates as chasa, which is what? Lettuce. I think even in the old French says something like letuga, which I assume is related to lettuce. So he tells him, first of all, don't seek after that very bitter thing, because the Mishnah gives us a different idea to use lettuce. Okay, that's one point in favor of us Romaine and endive folks. But he continues, and he says, V'amar Reb Shmuel v'Nachmani amar v'Yonasan, lama nimshulu mitzrim kemar? Why were the Egyptians compared to mar, to bitter herb? Lomar lacha, ma marer zeh shetchilaso rach v'sofo kasha, af mitzrim tchilasan raka v'sofon kasha. That just as they began soft, right, when the Mitzrayim began to subjugate us, we didn't even realize we were being enslaved. First they were going to pay us, we had this great deal of a new job, and slowly they started paying us less, as the Medrash says, and then took away the pay altogether, and then made the work much harder, and until we were full-blown slaves in a terrible situation. It started out rach, soft, with sofo kasha, and became difficult at the end. So tomorrow, its tchila, its beginning is rach, is soft, with sofo kasha, and its end is difficult. What does that mean? I know that when my wife and I, we tend to check like one bag of lettuce at the beginning of the week, and then we have it throughout the week, and usually by Thursday, I'm the only one who will eat it because it's so bitter, right? Romaine lettuce, first of all, it starts getting a little red, it starts getting a little bitter. It starts out tasting sweet, but at the end of a few days, it starts getting bitter. And that's exactly parallel to how the Mitzrayim enslaved Klal Yisrael. They started out treating us nicely, treating us warmly, and slowly, before we even realized it, we were enslaved and we were being terribly tortured by the Mitzrayim. And this Amor of Acha Brei Derava responds, Amarlai Hadribi. Okay, I give in. You're right. The horseradish maybe isn't the best way to go. Maybe I'll go with the lettuce, because that really represents the idea of how the Mitzrayim took us from Tchilas and Rachav Asofon Kasha, represented by the Romaine lettuce, the endives, whatever lettuce of our choice. And it's interesting, this actually plays out La'alacha, my Rebbe of Tversky also last year pointed out. The Chazon Ish was against using romaine lettuce while it is not yet, but while it's still sweet, before it becomes bitter. And so Rav Tversky said he was probably based on the Rambam's understanding of maror, which is that maror is an adjective. In other words, it describes all vegetables that are bitter. Maror means bitter. It describes all vegetables that are bitter. But Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach disagreed with the Chazon Ish. And he said, really, you can use lettuce even when it's still sweet before it gets bitter. And Retorsky explained, because he doesn't think maror is an adjective like the Rambam may think, but it's based on certain other Rishonim, that it's a noun. Mashal ma'adavar dome. When I say that I'm going to eat an orange, or the orange family of fruit, that doesn't mean that a carrot is an orange just because a carrot is the orange color, right? Orange is not an adjective that describes anything that is orange. It's a certain type of fruit. Maror as well doesn't just mean anything bitter. It means very particular species of foods that are bitter. And suggestive of Tversky, maybe that specifically means things that start rach and then slowly become more bitter as we eat them. And maybe that's why we specifically eat the romaine lettuce and the endives. Maybe ask your local posek, maybe ask Ray Galler whether horseradish is even acceptable at all for maror. It's an interesting question. I just saw Rav Willig address it in his brand new Haggadah, and he says, Ideally, you shouldn't really have horseradish. You should eat it on the side of your korech, but after the first bite, first eat the romaine lettuce, and then get to the maror of the horseradish, just to be mekayim that minog in Klal Yisrael. But that's a halacha question. Maybe the symbolism of the maror of the romaine lettuce and of the endives is this is exactly what, while we're tasting it still sweet, we realize that this is exactly how the Mitzrayim tricked us. This is exactly what it felt like right before things got really bad. And that itself is sort of one of the parts of the suffering, in a sense, that it started out that we thought everyone was friendly, everything was going to go fine, and then obviously it went downhill from there. So next time your horseradish schnobs are looking askance at you eating your romaine and endives, you can, first of all, defend yourself and also share this wonderful insight.
So, Rav Yair, I want to thank you for coaxing up a memory of my grandfather in the backyard, grinding the horseradish with a box grinder. My grandmother not letting it back in the house until everything was safely away. So thank you for that. I appreciate that time travel. It's not a coincidence that earlier I did Vihisha Amda, and now I'm going to do Sho Chamascha Elagoyim. The trip had a very strong impact on my feeling. Like, you know, how do we process what's going on today? So there's an interesting halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, in the halachas of Hanukkah. Another transition. Normally, when we light our Chanukiyos, where do we light them? We light them in the window. Want to make sure everybody can see them. When my wife and I were newlyweds living in Brooklyn, there's a small Jewish community in Brooklyn. When you drive around on Hanukkah, it is amazing to see thousands of Chanukiyos in the windows. The Ashkenazi customs, the one of the rare places where we follow the Rambam and Sfaradim follow the Tosfos, that every single person who's old enough to light a menorah, there's a menorah. And you know, some of the mishpachas in Brooklyn are pretty big. So that means there's a lot of beautiful menorahs. But there is a shaila. What if I live in a time where putting my menorah outside my house or lighting it in a very public fashion is going to generate some less than optimal feelings towards the Jews? So it's clear, b'di'eved, if one likes the candles and their kitchen table with the shades drawn and only the b'nei mishpabayis, only the members of the family see it, that is a valid halachic manner of lighting the candles. So this halacha, when we read this halacha in the Shulchan, it says there were times when we would be living with a great deal of timidity. We wanted to keep things very, very betzina, very, 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 very much, as the kids say, on the down low. I remember when I was a child at the Seder at my grandparents' house, I remember when we would get to Shvoch HaMaskal Lagoyim, that it was my job to open the door. And at no moment when I would open the door did I ever feel any twinges of fear, paranoia, concern that maybe something terrible was going to happen. I think most of us in our lives, Baruch Hashem, Bli Ayin Hara, felt that way. But this year we might be feeling a little bit more concerned. There's a little bit more security around the shuls. There's a little bit more sensitivity to what's going on. So I thought it might be worth, and so I have two questions. Question number one is, why are we saying this before Hallel? It's a strange thing to say, Hallel. Hashem, Shvoch HaMaskal Lagoyim Asholo Yedu'ucha, V'amam L'chos Asher B'Shimchol Lo Karo. So why are we saying this before Hallel? But I think if we understand why we're saying before Hallel, we might be able to answer some more questions. I would point out to you, there's a very beautiful Haggadah, the Haggadah Shlema of Rav Kasher. So he tells us something interesting. If we look in our modern Haggadah, we have several lines for Shvoch HaMaskal. But if we look on page, if you want to follow along, page 177, it's something which gradually grew. What do I mean? That originally, if we look in the Haggadah of the Rambam, or the Haggadah of the Rabbeinu Sadigon, this does not appear. This is something which started creeping in. And interestingly enough, as Jewish history continued, another pasuk, another verse, where we're expressing our desire of a Kaddish Baruch Hu to take care of our enemies would become more and more, kind of like snowballing, if you will. Why? Because our sojourn in the Gullus has had some ups, but there's been plenty of downs. So I'd like to swing back, I'd like to loop back. Shvocha Chamasch Al Agoyim, which Goyim are we asking a Kaddish Baruch Hu to mete out his divine wrath? Upon whom do we want him to mete out his divine wrath? So there are three key words. Asher lo yida'ucha. The concept here is we want the Kadosh Baruch Hu to mete out his wrath on those individuals who don't know him. We've heard it mentioned. Rabbi Gala talked about it. Rabbi Bramwich talked about it. This idea, like Paro is the exemplar of Mi Hashem. Who is this God of which you speak? Could you imagine for a second if Paro actually was convinced that on the hierarchy of powers in the universe, there was something above Paro? Could you imagine if Paro was a Chozer B'Tshuva, the ripple effect it would have had throughout all mankind? That would have been unbelievable. It would have been the biggest miracle of all. The issue that sorrows come in the world when people forget to keep HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to calculate HaKadosh Baruch Hu in their decision making. Is this something God would approve of? Is this something God would disapprove of? And then we think of all of the terrible things that are done in the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but that's a different story for a different time. Our issue is not we should have negative feelings towards everybody, but it's very, very qualified. The issue is what happens to people when they have no recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in their lives. When we take away, the word we would call that of recognizing HaKadosh Baruch Hu would be called morality, human decency, recognizing we come from the same root. It doesn't matter what your religion is. It doesn't matter what you look like. If we all recognize we all come from the same father, much of the suffering of human beings, I think, would evaporate like a fog on a summer morning. And when we're saying this right before Hallel, is we're saying that HaKadosh Baruch, Hallel is, what's the key of Hallel? When we're singing the praises of Hashem, that is the ultimate expression of Yediyas Hashem. It's saying, I understand Hashem, and I'm so in love with Hashem, and I'm so aware of Hashem, I'm overflowing with song, I'm overflowing with joy. And that overflow of joy in Simcha is the ultimate expression of Yediyas Hashem, and our singing of Hallel this year should be really to the tune of everybody should be knowing Hashem, as we say in the end of Aleinu, Vayom Ahu, Yi Hashem Echad, Ushmo Echad.
I'm actually going to use the Siddur to discuss Chasal Siddur Pesach, and I'll explain in a minute. When we begin Nirtza, we have this paragraph of Chasal Siddur Pesach, that we've completed the order of Pesach, Kil Chaso, as it is supposed to be done, Kechol Mishpato B'Chukoso, according to all the laws and customs, and Chukim Kasher Zachin L'Sader Oso, just as we were Zocha, as we merited to order it, to organize it, Keiniz Kelasoso, so too, we should be zoche to actually perform it, to do it. And so when I was in Karen B'Yavne, Rav Shlomo Freeman, who's one of the Rebbeim there, pointed out to us, it's a strange thing to say, kasher zachinu l'sader oso, kein nizkeh l'asoso. Just as we have organized it, so too we will perform it. What did we organize that we're davening that we should be able to perform? We usually assume that's talking about the Korban Pesach, doing the real Seder in Yerushalayim with the Korban Pesach and all of Klai Yisrael together. The issue with that understanding is that we didn't really do that. We were not organizing the Korban Pesach throughout the Seder. We talk about Sidur Yetzias Mitzrayim. We talk about everything discussed tonight. We don't really organize Sidur Pesach Kil Chaso. So what does it mean, Kasher Zachinu L'Sader Oso Keinizke L'Asoso? So he pointed out that the origin of this paragraph really isn't in the Haggadah. It's sort of co-opted from a very long piyut by Rav Yosef Tuv Elem, that is meant to be said on Shabbos HaGadol, before Pesach. And what Rav Yosef Tuv Elem does, is he has a very, very long poem, essentially, about all the halachos that relate to Pesach. And at the very end, he has a lengthy piece about the whole Seder, of Leil HaSeder, of what we do, going through all the Simanim Kadesh, Urchatz, etc. And at the very end of that, it should be on page 384, in the Yitzchak Yair Siddur, which I think here they do not say these Yotzros on Shabbos HaGadol, thankfully. Otherwise, Chazar Zashatz would be significantly longer. On page 384, at the very end of this piyut, after something like 4 or 5 pages, we have Chasal Sidr Pesach Kil Chaso. Right? So what does this mean in its original context? Chasal Sidr Pesach Kil Chaso. Where Yosef Tevelim is saying, we're standing on Shabbos HaGadol, it's about to be Pesach, I just gave you a whole poem going through the entire, all the halachos of Pesach, and the Seder of the night, the Seder night, and we've completed that now. Kasher Zachinu L'Sader, also just as we've been merited to organize this in this poem, Kein Nizga La'Soso, we should merit to do all of this and fulfill all these halachos on the Seder night. So what Chasal Seder Pesach is actually originally a prayer for is essentially what we're doing here. Right, we're trying to be mesader the seder. We're trying to organize our thoughts for the seder night beforehand, and we're davening kein nizge la'soso. So too, we should be zocha. We should merit to actually do that. To actually have a seder night that's as magnificent and as inspiring as all of the ideas that I organized beforehand, that I put forth beforehand in my mind. And what I want to say about that is that that's very nice in theory, but it almost never happens in practice. Right, when we go to Shiurim and we think about ideas we want to share at the Seder, and then it doesn't always work out exactly as we planned. We wanted to say a certain thing at a certain time, but this one had his Dvar Torah from kindergarten, and this one just came back from Yeshiva in Israel, so he says a 12-minute Dvar Torah that no one understood. And we can never really have a Seder exactly as we wanted. And we're not the only ones that have this issue. Rav Aaron Lopiansky, one of the most articulate and thoughtful Rabbanim in our times, wrote an article back in 2019 where he expressed this exact same sentiment. He says as follows in the beginning of this article, quote, after an exhausting day of Passover cleaning, he's writing to his son, you have sunk into the sweetest of sleeps, and I am sitting here with a pile of Haggadahs preparing for Seder night. Somehow the words never come out the way I want them to, and the Seder evening is always unpredictable. But so many thoughts and feelings are welling up in my mind, and I want to share them with you. These are the words I mean to say at the Seder. And he goes on to give a beautiful drasha about passing on the Masorah, etc. So even Rav Aaron Lopiansky says, the Seder night never goes exactly as planned. And yet, we daven chasal sidr pesach kil chaso. G'chomish batov v'chukaso, kasher zachin l'sader also, the more we put into organizing and thinking about how we're going to engage everyone at the Seder, how we're going to organize our thoughts and make it meaningful, especially this year, and really put in effort beforehand, it's not going to go exactly like that. We know that in reality, but it'll definitely enhance our Seder tremendously. Be'ezus Hashem.
In more than one place, Chazal repeat the idea that everything follows the chasima. Everything follows the ending, and the ending gives a stamp and really gives color to the entire thing that came before it. If that's true, then Chag Gadol should be the clarity that we're looking for to really cap off the Seder. And yet, as we know, whether we follow the Vilna Gaon's approach, the Chasam Sofer's approach, Chag Gadol is nothing short of just confusing. It's a strange way to end the Seder. We've discussed in the past the Chida and the Chaim Sha'al. A few years ago, we discussed Chasam Sofer, we discussed the Vilna Gaon. This year, I want to share a different thought, and I want to thank, actually, Ari Silberger, for the Haggadah they gave me a couple of years ago as a gift, which is From Despair to Destiny. Rav Ari Marcus Shlita, who is the Yeshiva Reish Shalayim, and now in Beit Shemesh, in my day it was in the Old City. He gives such a fantastic insight into Haggadah, but not really about the texts and all the animals and all the goings-on, more about the fact that it's in Aramaic. Wouldn't we think to end our Seder after the entire night we want to speak in the language that's comfortable, Lashon HaKodesh, it's been most of the Seder besides, you know, a paragraph here, a paragraph there. It's all been in Lashon HaKodesh, in Hebrew. We end off with this Aramaic long song, which is almost incomprehensible, about animals eating and fires and what's going on here. So Rav Ari says, he points out that if we think of the Seder as bookends, what if the latter end is Chag Gadol, what's the beginning, the front end? Halach Ma'anya. Halach Ma'anya. Which is also, by the way, in Aramaic. Well, look back for 1 second. Rav Ari Marcus says, why is Halach Ma'anya written in Aramaic? There are so many theories written, I can't even give you all 50, 60 plus answers why it's in Aramaic. But on a simple level, he says that, imagine the following. I'm giving my own mushal here, adding to what he said, adding some color. Imagine that you are a student in university, and all the classes are in English. And if one day your professor comes in
and starts to speak in Latin with some words, you know, speckled in with English. Or you're in a different country. You're in Israel, and you're, you know, an American student, and you start hearing the professor speak in Hebrew. And you feel like, oh my gosh, I'm overwhelmed. I'm like lost. I can't comprehend. I can't follow what's going on. That's exactly why, he writes, Halach Ma'ani is in Aramaic. If you would have told the Jews at the time they were in Mitzrayim, look, I know you're slaves now. Here's what's going to happen. Hashem's going to come. He's going to bring all these makos upon the Egyptians and Paro. And they're going to start crying out, giving you their gold and silver. You can go out. Moshe Rabbeinu told them that. What happened the first time? He said, Moshe, come on. We don't believe you. It's not going to happen. You know, here we are. This is what it is. We're slaves. We're here. Okay. Make the best of it. Very good. They wouldn't have comprehended. They wouldn't have understood how that could happen. How could it be we're going to go from the lowest of the low to the highest of the high in a geula in one night? How's that going to be? And yet, it happened. Halach Ma'ani is the idea. We begin the Seder by saying it was totally incomprehensible. The Jews could not have even imagined going from where they were in slavery to going out on the night of the Exodus, headed towards the Yam Suf, headed towards Matan Torah. They couldn't have even imagined the wildest dream, and yet it happened. Whenever you want to express an idea that's beyond comprehension, you know what you do? You change the language. You say it in different language because it shows you, I'm used to Lashon HaKodesh, Aramaic. Something uncomfortable, something unusual. It gives us a chance to pause to realize this was totally not able to be understood by the Jews. They couldn't have imagined in their wildest dreams what would happen on that night. We ate matzah, we left Mitzrayim. Rav Ari says the same thing at the end of the Seder, Chagadya. What Chagadya really about, with all the different mishalim, all the different parables in Chagadya, all the cat and the dog and the stick and the fire, it's about the future. It's about the future geula of our people. You tell somebody now, Rahman al-Hassan, what we're going through now, with all the anti-Semitism, and all of the challenges facing Klal Yisrael. You tell the average Jew, and not people in this room, but the average Jew on the street, you know, geula is coming. We're about to experience, I'm telling you, I see signs of the Mashiach. How many times in the past 6 months? And Baruch Hashem, it gives us hope, and it should, and give us strength. Have we had someone send a video to us and say, you see what happened here in this little story where the rocket fell? This happened, right? You heard the story by Finkelstein told before about the Pesach, the rockets flying overhead. And you say, wow, that's a simon of the Geula Hasidah. It's a simon, something great is going to change, something's going to come. How many times? So Chagat is written in Aramaic because just like Halach Ma'anya signifies something the Jews could never have understood, even if you explained it 1,000 times to them. And so we changed the language to indicate it was totally beyond their comprehension. So to Chagat, the same thing is going to be the feeling in the Zman, the final Geula, Yemos HaMashiach. The Jews, we could not imagine how good Hashem is going to be to us at that time. And we end the Seder with a hope and a prayer that God willing, just as Halach Ma'anya, written in Aramaic, we couldn't see it, but it happened. And it happened and it was great. And it landed us in a great place. The same thing is going to happen, Chag Gadya, in the future Geula. We can't see it always right now, but it's going to happen and it's going to be great. And that's how we end the Seder. Halach Ma'anya, Chag Gadya, Aramaic, that's a thought. I want to end with one story that I actually told a few years ago, but I think in the current times it's worthwhile to tell again. Not just current times in our community, but current times in Klal Yisrael. And it's always a important point to end with. We focus so often on, and one of the Rabbanim said this before, I think it was Rabbi Kaplan, about the details in terms of the halachic fulfillment of certain mitzvahs, which kind of maror, which kind of matzah, you know, how big the matzah, the cards, the measuring. But often in all those details, in the halachas of Pesach, and there are many, that's why it's Shloshim Yom Kodem L'Chag. You know, there's a story of the Sanzerav. Somebody once asked him, I think it was the Sanzerav, they said, what is the Rav learning? It's, you know, Sukkos is over. What's the Masechta? What's Choras Man going to be? The Sanzerav said, Maseches Pesachim. He says, Pesachim. Why are you learning Pesachim? You know, it's after Sukkot. He says, you know my halachos are in the laws of Pesach? I got to start Pesachim after Sukkot to get to finish it by the time Pesach comes around. It's true. Right? There's so many details that we focus on, but yet we lose something in the process. And let me share a story that really highlights that. There was a great Rav, the Chabina Rav. Zatzal Reberishto Wiedenfeld. He was a Rav in Poland in the 19th, 20th century, moved to Eretz Israel. And he was among the many Talmidei Chachamim and Poskim of his time, his generation. He was also a Rav HaMachshir, who people would ask for a Haskama for different things, businesses. And when it came to Pesach, he was a big player in terms of giving Hashgacha on matzah factories. And so one gevir, one fellow who had a big matzah factory, wanted the Rav, the Shabina Rav's Haskama on his factory. And so he said, would the Rav come to my factory to see what our operation and give it his stamp of approval that we do things quickly, there's no cheshash of chimutz, all that kind of stuff. So they brought him in, and he walks around, and he notices something unusual. He said, the workers seem so anxious, they seem so nervous. And he's walking, everyone is so still, it's like eerily quiet. He keeps going around, and just everyone he sees, how's the Rav doing? Everything seems so misudar, something seems off. So he pulls a worker aside, and he says, my high, like, what's going on? Why is everyone behaving just so perfectly? So the worker said, please don't tell that anyone that I told you. Before the Rav came, a few days before, the boss walked around. He was so uptight, yelling, like, do this, do that. The rabbi's coming. Everything's got to be perfect. The rabbi's coming. Got to be perfect. Got to be perfect. There was so much lachatz. Everyone today feels so, we love that you're here, but we're also like in line and scared what happened before. So at the end of the tour, the owner says to the Shabina Rav, so what does the Rav think of our factory? You're going to give it, I want to write your name, certified by the Shabina Rav. He said, your factory is amazing. I would say out of all factories I visited, the furthest cheshash chima, it is the most unbelievably kosher factory. Huh, can I have your letter? No. No. He said, part of kashrus on Pesach is not just bein adam lamakom, it's bein adam lachavero. A matzah factory that only observes bein adam lamakom is not kosher matzah for the mitzvos of Pesach. Just to end with the thought that while we're certainly focusing so much on the details of halachos bein adam lamakom and having the right sizes and maror, what should we choose, not choose, sometimes lost in the process is the kindness towards one another. And the idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants more than anything else a very equal balance. Of course, to try our best to fulfill all the Pratim and Shulchan Aruch and all the poskim in terms of our matzah and maror, our seder, and what we say at the seder, that's all very important, but never at the expense of Ben Adam Lachavero. We should hopefully, wishing all of us, I want to thank the Rabbanim again for all their contributions tonight and always over the course of the year. Wishing all of us an uplifting, truly inspiring Yom Tov. One where we're here as the Manachir Seiner for all of our hostages, all of our soldiers, and freedom, true freedom, for all of our people. And hopefully a meaningful Yom Tov of not just Ben Adam Lamako, but also Ben Adam Lachadir. Chag Kasher v'Sameach. Thank you.